Ambassador College and the Worldwide Church of God presents Gunner Ted Armstrong. All literature offered on this program will be sent free of cost to anyone requesting it.
Our Earth is literally teeming with countless millions of marvelous creatures, each with its own unique, intricate, and complex forms of behavior. Some, like the common spider, are master architects and builders. Others, like the little grunion fish, have an absolutely uncanny, built-in biological clock that tells them when to spawn and when to reproduce. But did such special behavior evolve? Did it just happen, as many people believe, or are such wondrous creatures proof of a great designer, an all-intelligent creator God? It's easy to get so involved in our day-to-day pursuits of business, of education, of homekeeping, of the strife and the turmoil of the big inner urban complexes of these sprawling megalopolises of ours that it's kind of tough to really see what you could call the handiwork of God. I mean, walking down amongst the big canyons of concrete cities, you don't see the marvels that you can see in a setting like this of something that really draws you closer to the concept that there had to be a creator for the creation. That there had to be a life giver for life, that there had to be a law giver for the absolutism of the laws that act upon us and upon all the beautiful, intricate creatures around us. In the Bible, in Romans, the first chapter, it talks about knowing the eternal Creator God by looking at those things which He has made. And just as surely as you can look at perhaps an architect's work, as you can look at a beautiful painting and know a little bit about the character or the mind of the artist that produced it. So, by looking at the intricacy of the marvels of creation around us, the little creatures as well as some of the largest that swim the seas or walk the earth, you can grow closer to and understand more about the mind of the great Creator God that produced it all. This beautiful gem we call Earth, this green, gorgeous little speck of life out here in the universe, is a place that is so awe-inspiring and so breathtaking that it just literally is beyond description. In this program, we're going to show you just a very few, like a tiny keyhole glimpse of a little bit of what's available in the great out-of-doors in this beautiful Earth of ours. And you're going, I think, to catch your breath from time to time in this program as you look at the intricacies, at the interdependability, at the design and the uniqueness of some of these incredible creatures and the way they perform, and you're going to see the proof of a Creator God. Spiders are among the world's most fascinating inhabitants. About 75,000 different kinds have been estimated to occur on the earth. Some huge ones, like the Mexican tarantula, are big enough to eat a mouse. Others are so tiny they're very hard to see with the naked eye. Actually, spiders are not insects, even though we think of them as insects. Technically, they're classified in the arachnid family. All spiders, regardless as to size, can spin silk, and they use this remarkable gift in many ways. Unlike the larvae of insects, which spin from their mouths, spiders have a set of tiny spinnerets in the back underside of their bodies. The spider can produce different kinds of silk for different uses. A spider can spin a line of silk 1/1,000,000th of an inch in diameter. Yet, this single line has such elasticity that it can stretch 1/5 of its length before breaking. Its tensile strength is surpassed only by fused quartz fibers. It simply cannot be duplicated by science in the laboratory. Steel is weak by comparison. But surely the most amazing achievement of the spider is that marvelous architectural masterpiece known as the web. The spider's web is a construction job par excellence, as well as a strong and dangerous trap for catching prey. Here, we're watching a common garden spider as she works. Although no two webs are exactly alike, there's a basic procedure which we can describe. First, the garden spider makes a strong foundation for the web. She usually strengthens the foundation with short lines across the corners. Next, she drops a line across the center of the space she has prepared. Working from this, she runs a series of lines, much like the spokes of a wheel. Next, she goes to the center and spins threads to strengthen the hub of her web. From the center, she spins out a temporary thread to hold the spokes in place. She now fills in the web with closely placed sticky threads, cutting away the temporary thread. In addition, many spiders build zigzag structures which strengthen the webs. The whole process is absolutely incredible, especially if you believe it all happened by chance and by evolution. Here we see a garden spider as she spins the sticky threads. With her back legs, she pulls them tight and fastens them into place. These sticky threads are the working part of the trap, and they're covered with droplets that will entangle insects. The amazing thing is that the spider never gets stuck. The spider's legs are covered with a kind of an oil that keeps them from sticking. At the center of the web, the garden spider weaves a lacework of silk where she sits head down and waits for a victim. With a large opponent like this grasshopper, the spider can stand back at a safe distance and throw her silk. But how did such an elaborate and complicated scheme for web building ever develop? Can you imagine a first spider trying in vain to catch insects in a kind of a proto-web, a web which was not a web, but a part web? Most spiders don't spin webs at all, by the way, even if they do have silk. Yet you can hardly say they had to spin. If they didn't have to, then why spend all those millions of years developing the ability? It doesn't make sense. In one of the NASA research satellites in outer space, spiders were carried aboard to see if they could weave their webs in zero gravity. The answer was yes. Even without reference information that gravity provides, the spiders were still able to carry out their web-building instincts. Actually, many spiders don't even have a home. Take the wolf spider, for example. These little creatures carry their egg sacs wherever they go, finding protection under stones, in trees, or by burrowing underground. They're obviously able to survive without many of the comforts of home. The wolf spider is a hunting spider and goes in search of prey instead of spinning a web to ensnare it. Another curious kind of hunting spider is the trapdoor spider we've all heard of. She lives in an underground tunnel that's fitted with a fantastic hinged trapdoor. The tunnel is lined with soft silk, specially designed to facilitate the capture of the spider's prey. It's another example of ways these little animals use their silk glands. The trapdoor, too, is made of silk, and it's camouflaged with pieces of dirt. The silk makes a surprisingly strong hinge for the door. Many an insect has passed too close to this remarkable trap. Prey captured by the trapdoor spider is taken inside the tunnel. Here, the spider can eat in the safety of its own den. Now, spiders can survive without undertaking the many remarkable schemes they have for acquiring food, so you ask the question, why evolve such laborious methods of getting your meals? How could they evolve such matchless engineering perfection? The abilities of spiders are so unbelievable as you watch this that you can scarcely believe what you're seeing. And yet, whether you live in Brooklyn or downtown St. Louis, or if all you've got is a geranium in a flower pot, the chances are you can look around if you can't get into the great outdoors and you can still watch marvels such as these right there at home. Watch a spider spin a web sometime. Point it out to your children. Take a look at the marvels of creation other than just what man does around you and learn to appreciate the wisdom, the humor, the warmth, the love, the tremendous mind of the Creator God, whom I firmly believe made, designed, created, and who sustains all of these things.
Many of the wonders of the world around us deserve to be stopped and appreciated in greater detail. To complement its articles on world events, financial planning, religion, and family issues, Plain Truth Magazine provides its readers with colorful layouts on nature and the world about us. If you would like an opportunity to stop and appreciate the marvels of creation in greater detail, send for your free subscription to the Plain Truth Magazine. There's no cost or obligation.
Another fascinating creature is the familiar little insect, the ant. There are at least 3,500 recognized species of ants in the world, and each has its own habits. Now here you see one of the most interesting and amazing ant groups of all. These tropical insects are called leaf cutters. They strip whole trees or shrubs of their leaves and carry them back to the nest. The largest worker ants from the colony snip the leaves into sizes suitable for carrying, and other workers cart them off. The parade of ants to and from the nest can literally wear down conspicuous paths through the tropical forests. An ant is unimaginably strong and can carry 100 times its own weight. They can handle jobs which would be the equivalent of a man pushing a 5-ton truck uphill with 4 flat tires. All ants are adapted to live together in highly organized societies called colonies. Right now it looks confusing, but ants are actually incredibly organized. Now, to understand this, let's look at the very beginning of the colony, which started with one ant searching for a safe hiding place to lay her eggs. This is the queen ant, the largest of her species and a highly specialized and remarkable creature. Her only occupation throughout life is laying eggs and raising young ants. The queen feeds the precious larvae until they enter the pupal stage, which requires no food. At the end of the pupal stage of their development, the ants emerge small and weak, but ready to go to work. These are the worker ants, and like the queen, they're females, but are unable to reproduce. Here we see a well-fed worker, and it's being given some of her food to a hungrier worker, just as the nursery workers do for the larva or for the queen. Among the colony workers, which are all female, the largest and strongest act as soldiers, keeping a watch out for enemies which they attack to defend the colony. In each brood of new ants, only a few males are ever hatched. They're easily recognized by their wings. These have just emerged from the pupa cases in the laboratory. Larvae, which are specially fed and cared for, develop into queens. Queens also have wings and are larger than males. The males and queens do not work and must be fed by the workers, but they're necessary because without them, no new colonies could be started and ants would soon disappear. So the queen of the ant colony is able to selectively lay eggs which will develop into many different forms at the same time. Strikingly enough, the queen is actually able to predetermine the sex of her progeny. But most of these forms cannot reproduce themselves. They are sterile or neuter. And this is the real problem for evolution when you stop to think about it. The founding of a new colony is a marvelous event all in itself. On a warm, humid day amidst much excitement in the colony, males and queens gather at the nest entrance to fly away. This is called the marriage flight, a special occasion for all ants. Sometimes the winged ants climb to the tops of high plants or rocks before taking off to join marriage flights from other colonies. While in the air, the males will mate with the queens. After the marriage flight, the males die, but the queens live on. They shed their wings, find a safe place to lay their eggs, and start new colonies. The amazing thing is that the ants from many different colonies will often fly on the same day, even at the same time. By some uncanny timing mechanism, the whole colony just seems to know when it's time to begin that vital flight, during which the queen will become fertile for life. And yet we're asked to believe that every bit of this evolved. As a matter of fact, the theory of evolution, beginning with Charles Darwin, mentioned the very strange factor of neuter gender for these ants and the fact that they could not reproduce. And he called it a really terrible problem for evolution. To quote his words on the subject in The Origin of Species, the famous book which many of you certainly have read, he said, and I quote, "With the working ant, we have an insect differing greatly from its parents, yet absolutely sterile, so that it could never have transmitted successively acquired modifications of structure or instinct to its progeny." You know, one thing about ants is this, that they have ants preserved in amber in the fossil rocks of the soil of this earth of ours. Amber is, you know, virtually a precious material in that sense of what it would bring, I guess, on the market. But the ants that you can see in this translucent or almost transparent amber are exactly like the modern ants of today. The fossil record preserves all kinds of creatures, some of which they say have become extinct. The point of the ants in amber that are supposed to be millions or uncounted billions of years of age is simply this, that there has been no change whatsoever in the anatomical or the physiological structure of the ants over these millions upon millions of years, yet all during the time the ants remained exactly the same, all these phenomenal dramatic changes in evolution were supposed to have occurred, including the arrival of man. You're asked to believe that your intelligence, that your nature, your humor, your warmth, your perception, your creative or your possible ability of creation, such as in art or music or what have you, your own nature, your own heredity, came out of randomness. That you're the result of happenstance, of chance, of accident. It's like saying, as I've said so many times on a program, that an explosion in a print shop could produce the Encyclopedia Americana with all the updates from year to year. It's like saying that haphazard accident and chaos produces some of the most intricate, interdependent design that your mind could ever comprehend. Well, Darwin said, and I quote, and it's an interesting statement, "It may well be asked," after he had admitted that this could never have been transmitted in many generations, these modifications of structure, "it may well be asked, how is it possible to reconcile this case," the case of the neuter ants, "with the theory of natural selection?" Unfortunately, Charles Darwin never got around to really reconciling that problem, and modern evolutionists have never been able to reconcile it, or many others either. And that's just the point, because these highly specialized workers differ markedly from father or mother or any other of their own species, even each other. So Darwin said they differed, and I quote his words, "to an almost incredible degree." And then you're still asked to assume that by millions and billions of so-called natural selection, these ants evolved. Well, they had to instantly begin doing exactly what they're doing today to survive, because that's what their survival is all about. So they couldn't have survived without passing on characteristics to their offspring that are identical to the ones that they themselves possess. And yet they should be extinct under these so-called assumptions, and they're certainly not laws. So no wonder Darwin was worried about the little bitty ant. No, you cannot pass off all of the marvels of creation from the fossil record in the rocks, including fossil man and dinosaurs and all the rest of it, by saying it evolved. Wherever we look, whether in the sea, at the myriad creatures there and the forms of life all the way from algae and plankton to the huge great whales, or the land and man himself and mammals, or in the air to the creatures that fly, we see an interacting, interdependent web of life that comprises, like a dynamic, pulsating, living thing, the interacting web of life that really is our biosphere. Each creature in his own right is a separate study all by itself. Each with his own habits of protection, his own methods of food getting or of survival, his own speeds, or maybe if he's a slow-moving creature, his greater camouflage or protection in the form of a shell into which he can crawl backward and then carry it off with him if he needs to, is a very absorbing and interesting study, and I dare say something that has passed over all too lightly in most high school and college courses. We human beings are, after all, only tiny creatures that exist on a globe which is primarily made up of water. And why did we simply end up, as it is by chance, at the fortuitous end of a life web, or a food chain which begins in the sea, the air, the soil, and that we, as human creatures on this glittering orb we call the good Earth, orbiting endlessly in our own galaxy, are utterly unique in all the universe so far as we can know? The question is, how did it happen?
Life's been pretty good. Summer home, yacht, vacation when I want it. Some little kids sure spent a lot of time with that. Too bad they never last. Yeah, a lot of things are like that. Kids are grown now, and Sandy and I aren't getting any younger. Is this all there is?
You can know the answer to this age-old question, why were you born?
One of the most amazing and unbelievable examples of a living clock is a little grunion fish. I've tried to catch grunion with my bare hands many a time on Southern California beaches. Many others have too. Some certain nights during spring and summer months, sandy California beaches are the scene of a spectacular display by these small silvery fish that are called grunion. By the thousands, they come out of the ocean to lay their eggs in the wet beach sand.
Of all the fishes in the world, only the grunion have such unique spawning habits. Grunions spawn only on 3 or 4 nights following the new moon and full moon phases, and on these nights for only 2 or 3 hours after the time of high tide. Their sense of timing is absolutely essential for their survival, as we'll see in a moment. But first, notice what happens during a typical grunion run. The run begins about 20 minutes after high tide, with the heaviest part of the run occurring between 1 and 2 hours after high tide. At this time, there may be thousands of fish on the beach. Although vast numbers of fish are out of the water at one time, there are very few casualties. The female starts to dig in only when there are male fish nearby. If no males are close, she goes back to the ocean to return again on a later wave. The female shivers and sinks into the semi-fluid sand and begins to twist her body from side to side as she bores into the sand deeper and deeper. When her body is 1/2 to 3/4 buried, she releases her eggs. During this period, she remains motionless or moves her body slowly from side to side. There are many more males than females on the beach at any one time because the males come in many times on one run and for several nights after each moon phase. The females may come in several times before they lay the eggs, but once they have spawned, they do not return to the beach until 2 weeks later. After the spawning season starts, both males and females spawn every 2 weeks. And an individual female may spawn 4 to 6 times each season. She may lay anywhere from 1 to 3,000 eggs at each spawning. Thus, one female may lay as many as 18,000 eggs in one season. A large percentage of these eggs hatch, but very few fish reach adult size. Most are eaten by other fish, and of course, a lot of them are picked up by humans. The fertilized eggs can be found by digging a few inches into the sand. They lie in a ball and will be covered deeper by sand left by succeeding waves. In this relatively cool, damp place, the baby grunion will grow in the eggs. Here's the first sign of what will become the baby grunion, merely a cap of cells on the side of the yolk. By the 8th day, the embryo is almost ready to hatch and it wiggles often. It has increased greatly in size and we can plainly see that the yolk is now much smaller. The embryo has grown into a baby fish. When the embryo is 9 days old, it looks like a ball with 2 big eyes. We have a complete baby fish tightly curled inside the eggs. The eggs are now ready to hatch, but they will not hatch until agitated or shaken. If the eggs are not agitated, they will not hatch even if covered by water. Here's a group of mature eggs about 2.5 minutes after they have been shaken. Some of the eggs have already hatched and more fish are popping out of their shells every moment. Within about 5 minutes, almost all the eggs have hatched. At this time, our hatching bank resembles Times Square on New Year's Eve. The empty egg membranes float like balloons among the baby fish as they dash in all directions at once. Here we see a close-up of the grunion eggs as they hatch. Don't blink your eyes or you'll miss it. Watch the egg at the tip of the arrow. In case you missed the hatching, here's another chance. In a fraction of a second, the grunion twists and pops out of his shell, tail first. To understand some of the reasons why grunion are such remarkable examples of living clocks, you need to recall facts about ocean tides. Remember that there are about 2 low tides and 2 high tides every 25 hours. This diagram represents a cross-section of the beach as the level of the ocean rises and falls. If you follow the rise and follow the ocean tide with the white line, we'll get a tide trace, which is a picture of the height of the tide at any particular time. This is the tide trace for a period of about 1 month at a beach where grunion spawn. Blue bands in this drawing represent night, and yellow bands represent day. You can see the tide heights vary from day to day, and that the highest tides occur at the time of full moon and at the time of the new moon. The grunion, with little variation, spawn on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th nights after the full moon and after the new moon. This means that they are spawning after the time of high tide or at a time when the tide is declining. Now, sand is carried away from beaches when tides are increasing, but sand is deposited on beaches when tides are declining. So you can see that grunions spawn on nights and at the time of night when their eggs will be covered deeper by the sand. If they spawned when tides were getting higher, the eggs would be washed away by succeeding tides. We've also seen that it takes about 9 days for their eggs to develop. They must spawn at a time when their eggs will have 9 days in the sand before they're washed free. Eggs which are laid on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th nights following the highest tides will probably hatch from 1 to 3 nights before the next highest tide, as shown by the 3 arrows on the right of the diagram. If grunions spawn later than these 3 nights, their eggs will be washed out before they were ready to hatch. In addition, we have shown that the eggs hatch within a few minutes after they are agitated and not until they are agitated. In nature, this agitation comes when the eggs are washed free from the sand by waves of rising tides. The exact mechanism controlling the precise timing of the grunion is not known. But precise it is, because unless the grunion maintain their exact timing, they would have little chance of reproducing. They reproduce, and they do so in a strange and fascinating way.
This Is Your Life is a fascinating story when you're talking about human beings, but how much more fascinating is it when you're talking about the life cycle of a grunion? In the head of a pin, a little tiny fish like that has got to figure the exact time of the month, the exact wave of the exact high tide. You couldn't do that with a pair of water wings and a computer. You just couldn't do it. Well, what's the point of all of this? It's not just to entertain people by showing the intricacies and the marvels of creation around us. The beauty is only a really close-up camera can, even better than the human eye. It's to show you that not only is there a God, a great creator, all-wise, divine being who lives and exists and who created everything there is, including you, your mind and your body, the process by which you and I can draw this sweet breath of air in our lungs when we can get away from the smog, of course, and live life. It's more than that, though. It's to tell you that since there is such a God, and since you can prove it, you ought to be a little bit interested in what He's got in mind for you. You're more than a grunion, an ant, or a spider, I hope and pray, no matter what your wife or husbands call each other sometimes, like you beast, you insect, etc. But kidding aside, you are the only really important possession you've got. Your mind, your life, your being, your lifespan, your existence on this earth has got to be worth something more than just some boring, day-to-day, rut-like existence of the rat race of dog-eat-dog competition. There's got to be something greater in mind for you as this life is being lived. What is it? The book of Romans in the first chapter says you can understand the Creator and you can understand His purpose and His mind, His Godhead, His eternal divinity, and His power by looking at the things which are made. God is reproducing after His own kind. He is still in the process of creating. And you need to understand what is that creation process and what part should you be playing in it. The programs that I do have an awful lot more behind them than just the idea of telling people, oh yes, there is a God, so let's all walk through the daisies in the field or drive out in the great outdoors and say, isn't it nice that God made that? You better look into your own mind, your own body, your own heart, your own lifespan and say, God made this too. And what's it all about? Why am I here? Why was I born? You ought to write for these brochures that show you in step-by-step sequence that God Almighty does exist and that there is a great purpose and a great plan in mind that He has for you. Till next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
All literature offered on the Garner Ted Armstrong program is sent free of cost to anyone requesting it. Ted Armstrong again next week at this time. Brought to you by Ambassador College and the Worldwide Church of God.